Welcome back to another episode of Speaking to Stacey, the podcast sharing practical advice for an action-driven lifestyle. My name is Stacey Liddell, and today I had the opportunity to speak with a psychologist and author who has expertise in helping sports people achieve higher levels of performance. Before I introduce my guest, I want to say a big thank you for taking the time out of your day to listen in and learn something new. If you find this conversation entertaining or useful, please could I ask you to share the episode with one other person. You never know the positive impact this conversation could have on someone you care about. My guest today is Dr. Joe Lukens. Joe is an extremely productive psychologist and author. She's also a mother and shares her insights on a range of issues in today's episode. The great thing about Joe's work is that it's relevant to everyone, not just the sports people she comes into contact with. The three key benefits I want to highlight for the listeners today are number one, the importance of gratitude. Number two, how to create a performance mindset. And number three, understanding why you need good sleep and healthy fuel to improve your mental game. Please stick around until the end of the show if you want to hear Joe outline the importance of habits and some of her tips on creating habits that stick. So without further ado, I present to you Dr. Joe Lukens. Right, we have another episode of Speaking to Stacey, and today I've got Dr. Lukens with me. And Dr. Lukens, as we discussed before, the show normally has the process of the guests introducing themselves. So would you like to give a brief background into who you are and what you do, and then we can take it from there?
Sure, sounds great. Stacey, first of all, thank you for having me along on the show. I'm very grateful for that. So Joe is my name, so that's how most people refer to me. So thank you for the formal welcome, but please call me Joe through the interview. That'll be far more comfortable for me. So essentially, in a nutshell, what do? I help motivated individuals develop high-performance thinking without all the waffle. So I've worked in the space of sports and performance psychology and really in that mindset space for over 30 years now. So I'm based in Australia, and for those who know Australia, the northern part of Australia, so sunny Townsville is where I live with my family. So I'm married and have two teenage sons who keep me very busy. And when I'm not running around after all of them, I work with a range of different organisations and teams. So in Australia, rugby league is a very popular sport. I wouldn't go so far as to say it's the national sport, because the sports tend to argue over which is the national sport. But I work with one of the national teams, national clubs, which is the North Queensland Cowboys. And so we have a men's team that's been established. I've been with them since 1996 as their sports psychologist and mental skills coach. Excitedly, the women's program is starting for our club this year. So we'll have our first team in the NRLW League, which is it's fortunate to be part of a new program. I also work within professional basketball. So I support a team in the Women's National Basketball League here in Australia, a bit further from my hometown. I work with the Melbourne Boomers. And the other team that I work with from an elite sports perspective, again, a little further from my shores, is the Papua New Guinea Orchids, which is the Women's National Rugby League team. And we went on a great adventure at the end of last year where we travelled to the UK and the team participated in the World Cup. So there's 1,000 stories that could come out of that, Stacey. So that was a great experience. And when I'm not working in the elite sports space, I do consulting work within the Australian Defence Force. So I work with soldiers in a range of different areas, and we might touch on some of that. I do some consulting work, and I also like to do a bit of writing. So I've written a couple of books, and I've got one underway at the moment. So that's in a nutshell some of the ways that I keep myself busy and occupied.
Wow, very busy and very occupied. There are a couple of things you touched on, and maybe before we dive into more of the formal questions that I have surrounding your book, Jo was kind enough to share her book with me. The title is The Elite, and we can go into the book and chat a bit about that. But I wanted to ask you a few things that jumped out to me in your introduction. You talked about being a mom, and I wonder at all, does your your research and your thinking about mindset and sports psychology and performance, does that ever come home with you where you find yourself trying to get your kids to take on these principles as a mom? Because obviously you've seen how powerful and impactful they can be inside of sports and the military. Is that something that comes up as a mom and psychologist?
Every single day. Every single day, I think the connection between a psychological background and being a parent comes into play. Now, I hope people aren't hearing that and thinking that must mean I'm really good at both. So I make all the same mistakes that every parent does, because that's the normal part of parenting. And in fact, my second book, which is called In the Grandstands, which is a parent survival guide for teenage sports. So no guessing what phase of life I was in when I wrote that one. You know, I opened the book with a disastrous parenting story on my behalf involving myself, my youngest, and a swimming lesson. But I mean, certainly, you know, there's so much to learn about the way people think. I just think people are fascinating. And so certainly whilst my expertise isn't in young children, you know, I've always been really curious about how can I as a human do my best job of parenting, whatever that might look like, you know, and it'll be my best version on any given day, which doesn't mean it's always, you know, something that I couldn't do better. And it's certainly something I often talk to my children about, which is usually works quite well, except when they throw my own advice back at me, which one of them did at the moment. So a bit of context around that. My youngest is learning to drive at the moment. He's 16. Okay. And we took a corner a little quicker than I would have liked the other day, and I was giving him some, I'll say, feedback. And he pulled over and he looked at me and he said, "Mum, you need to respond, not react," which is, and I have a whole workshop based on that. And I went, yeah, anyway, we don't need to go into the rest of the details of the car trip. But, you know, so to answer your question, you know, there's so many lessons that we can learn from psychology and, you know, say in elite sport, but it applies to all of us. You know, we're all out there, most of us, trying to do our best, trying to be successful and whatever version of that might be. And so then what I like to do is try and translate some of the lessons of elite sport for anybody so that you can pick up little bits and pieces and try to make our lives closer to what we want that to be, whatever that might look like.
Okay, perfect. That makes a lot of sense. And the other thing I was intrigued by was the fact that you deal with quite different sports people. You deal with basketball players, you deal with rugby players, especially rugby league, which is a heavy contact sport. Is there a difference in the treatment of players in those sports based around the fact that there might be head injury in rugby? So let me unpack that a bit. What I mean is the fact that players might be coming back from things like concussion and struggling with knocks to the head, does that fall under your purview as the psychologist to help them deal with that and their mindset, or is that more towards the doctor's sides of things? Or is there, do you guys combine and help the players deal with overcoming those kinds of injuries?
Yeah, that's a great question, and particularly understanding research, knowledge, and responsibility around particularly head injuries is quite a current topic here in Australia at the moment, as I imagine it is across the world. So you're right, with where your question led to, it is a multidisciplinary approach to something like a head injury. And obviously we have neuroscientists and neurosurgeons and medical experts that obviously need to take the lead on the amount of injury and damage that has potentially happened for an athlete and then how that is managed. So physically that gets looked at first, and then depending upon what that means, you know, so we might have a player with a head knock, and if it's quite substantive, it might be about providing support to the athlete, but also to their families as well, you know, because if it's your loved one that's had a knock, and we know what that can be over time if you know, there's multiple injuries and so forth. So we look at it from that perspective. And then the other place within that journey where I may step back into the conversation is around how the athlete feels about returning to sport. My experience is that the majority are keen as mustard, and as soon as they can get back, they want to. However, understandably for some, there might be some trepidation, some concern, some worry, some anxiety around what another knock could mean, or, you know, and this probably we're particularly talking about head injury here, but this relates to any kind of physical injury. You know, if you've done your knee twice, or you've had just coming back from an ACL surgery or whatever it might be, it would be normal to have some level of hesitation and reservation around that. So certainly in the mental skills space, there are things that you can do to support athletes, to equip them with skills, to help them with their readiness to return to training, to playing and so forth. So I think particularly in those sports, like you say, when they're collision sports, injuries are inevitable. But I've also worked with, you know, swimmers and runners and, you know, all sorts of athletes from different backgrounds. And so the injury piece plays out in different ways. But ultimately the common characteristic is it's people going through it. So that's where there's the opportunity to help.
I find it interesting that you talked about that trepidation coming back. As we discussed before, jumping on, I spoke to you about, you know, having a few knee injuries and calling it quits, having to choose between sort of the long-term view of being able to go for just a casual run on the weekends versus having sort of messed up my knees. I think also what plays into that is my dad has bad knees as well. And obviously his generation, the availability to the technology of the surgery that I had wasn't there. So his knees, shame, essentially were butchered and didn't help for his long-term recovery. And his knees today are not what they used to be. So that I think played into my mind as well, hearing his stories and him sort of talking about the pain that he experienced as an adult. For me, it was when I came back to play, when I reflect on it, I don't think I really felt it consciously. I was, as you said, you know, the Australian saying keen as mustard. I was so eager to get back. I wasn't thinking about the injury when I was going through rehab and training. All I wanted to do was return to the field. But what I did start to notice was when I was on the field and when I was running, I definitely was running within my limits. I would be carrying the ball. So specifically in six down touch rugby, which I played, I would offload the ball, I'd pass the ball. And then I'd think to myself, hold on a minute, why weren't you going full tilt there? It was all just subconsciously me overcompensating, trying to hold back so that I didn't re-injure the knee.
Yeah. Which when you think about it is a smart thing to do, because your body's learned that the last time that you did this potentially, it didn't go so well. So why wouldn't our body be clever enough? And then what we're trying to do is override, you know, what is it essentially becomes a basic instinct, you know, to do that. So, you know, I've spent a lot of time with injured athletes, and I mentioned to you before we started the show, my PhD focus was actually in injury. Interestingly, for that piece of research, I actually looked at, are there psychological variables that might predispose us, that will make us more at risk of injury? So, you know, typically sports psychology research in this space is looking at what are the psychological effects of injury and how does it affect us in terms of return. I was interested at the front end to see, is there anything, I mean, you know, what I need to say from the outset is that injury occurs for many, many reasons, and some of it is outside the control of the athlete. You know, if someone comes along and gives you a really big tackle, then, you know, you're kind of at the mercies of that. But what I was curious about is there anything about athletes that might make them more at risk of incurring an injury? And that was an interesting space to look at. And then I was particularly interested in the role of optimism and pessimism then in terms of recovery from injury. So that was where my areas of interest particularly lay.
That's so interesting. Was there anything that came out of that research that you could conclusively say that something in the mindset did impact the way that the athlete either handled the recovery or the predisposition to getting injury?
Yeah, there actually was. And so I guess just to make it clear for those who are listening, what the population, because that's important. So we know within research you generally would never want to, you know, extrapolate the data too far beyond the population that you're looking at, particularly if it's not a random sample. So I was working with elite athletes over a two-year period who played rugby league, and they were all male. So, you know, it's a very specific population, and it was done a number of years ago now. But I'm very happy to share what I found, because I think it can raise some curious questions around where to take this moving forward. But I do think there's some take homes from the research itself. So essentially, there were a couple of factors, but two that I'll mention is two psychological variables that seem to influence risk of injury. And one of them was the relative level of self-esteem of the athlete. So what it's tended to show is that for those players who had lower self-esteem, it increased their risk of injury by about 18%. You know, that was one of the things that was evident. Now, I need to be really clear in how I explain that. That does not mean, of course, that all athletes who get injured have low self-esteem, and it is still highly possible for someone with high self-esteem to get an injury, just as someone with low self-esteem to not get one. But one of the things, so when the coaches came back to me after I found that particular finding, they said, so what do you think's happening there? And of course, what I'm going with now is professional speculation, so I can't say for sure, but it makes sense to me that when you are low in confidence, when your self-esteem is low, that it's almost like your head is bowed to some extent. So what comes with lower self-esteem is self-doubt. And self-doubt is, if I pull off the example that you gave earlier, it's about going into a tackle and not feeling confident about it. It's about holding back, you know, those sorts of things that can happen. And it's in those moments of hesitation where we can make ourselves vulnerable to more injuries. So that was one of the things that made sense to me. And then the second part of the research, so in addition to having low self-esteem being an influencing factor on greater risk of injury, the second factor was, it's a little bit more of a jargon term, but it was a factor that measured the degree to which you become overloaded by internal thinking. So when you get overloaded by internal thinking, so what that means is internal thinking is all the things that are going on inside your head, you know, how am I going, what am I doing, what's my role, what's my responsibility, self-evaluating how I'm going. And I don't know if you've ever found it, Stacey, and I know I have sometimes under moments of high pressure, when you get really stuck inside your head and you stay there for a while, it becomes a bit overwhelming and overloading. So it would also make sense to me, looking at the data, that when you're feeling overwhelmed and almost like you can't get out of your head, if that's an appropriate way to describe it, you're less attuned to what's happening outside of you. And what's happening outside of you is there might be a divot in the grass that you don't notice, or there might be a player coming towards you, and because you're so caught up in what you're thinking within yourself, you don't position your body correctly to make a good tackle or to position yourself with the ball and those sorts of things. So what we find is, what I found was that being lowering confidence and self-esteem and just being a little bit overwhelmed and caught up inside your own thinking were the two variables that made athletes more at risk of injury.
Wow. When I look back at sports at high school and junior school, you'll often hear coaches and parents saying things to their kids or their boys. I was at a boys' school, so saying things like, always go into the tackle fully committed. Don't go into tackles half-heartedly. Don't hit a ruck half-heartedly. I wonder if that is sort of a principle that has embedded itself into contact sports like that, because there's some sort of anecdotal evidence that coaches have noticed that kids with lower confidence tend to get hurt, or people who don't commit themselves to tackles seem to walk away with more injuries. That's fascinating to think. I mean, obviously, that's just an anecdote, and I'm not saying there's any causation there.
It's a reasonable anecdote, though. Like, I would agree with you, Stacey. Like, we can't necessarily say, look, and here's the evidence to back that up, other than, you know, that's where good science comes from. It comes from initial observation. So there's plenty of scope there for some motivated researchers to do some more work in this space. But it makes sense, doesn't it, that level of engagement and commitment in the task can influence our ability to execute it well. And if I can pick up on a point, I hope it's okay if I do this, Stacey, of something that you just said, is that message that's often given, say, to junior athletes, but I see it with adults as well, is a message from a coach or from a parent that says, go in with your full effort, don't go in half-hearted. But the other thing that people often say is, you need to be more confident. You need to go in with confidence. Now, interestingly, and this is for anyone who's listening who has anything to do with athletes, the feedback I'd love to share with you is that when I speak to athletes who've been told, you need to be more confident, what's often understood by that athlete is the person who's told it doesn't think that I'm confident. So when you tell someone, I don't think you're confident, what it often does, unfortunately, is it further erodes your confidence. So it's a tricky conversation, because if you think of an athlete you know who is really who is confident, you don't typically go up and congratulate them on their confidence and say, hey, I think your confidence is great, keep going. We only seem to point out to vulnerable athletes who we think aren't confident. And for many of them, by pointing that out, it actually makes it worse. It's tricky. So the phrasing you use with athletes, and I know, you know, this is something that you often sort of talk about, Stacey, but the phrasing and the way that we speak to people is so incredibly important, because we do pick up on the subtleties. It does influence the way we think, and then that influences our actions as well.
Yeah, that's so true. I think, and maybe we can talk a bit about the book, because one of the things that I noticed, and I often wonder if it's a maturity thing, and maybe you can speak to that a bit. I wasn't very intentional about, especially about self-talk when I was a lot younger. And I think a lot of the ideas and things that were going through my head when I was younger, I think came from external sources. So for example, you know, that some of the things running through my head were given to me or handed down to me by parents and by coaches and by staff members at schools and things like that. So, you know, the things that you say to yourself before a rugby game often came from the outside, because as a young person, I don't know, you're formulating yourself and you're trying to figure out what works and doesn't work for you. So you grab bits and pieces from your environment and you incorporate into your own thinking. But as I've gotten older, I'm now 33 for the people that don't know, I've become a lot more intentional about what I think and how I think. And I ask myself the question, you know, where did that thought come from? Is that mine, or has that been brought in from the outside? And by going through that process, I think it's amazing to see some of the things that I've said about myself. So one good example is, I used to believe that I'm an all or nothing person. So for things like drinking alcohol, either I'm going to have no alcohol today, or I'm going to have a lot of alcohol. There was no middle ground for me, because I kept on repeating to myself, I'm an all or nothing person. And I just wonder, is there a way that you help people become sort of more intentional about their thinking? And how to help people discern between, you know, what is mine? What do I actually believe? And what has been given to me, or what have I taken from the people around me, or from my parents, or things like that? Yeah, could you speak to that?
Yeah, I could, and there's so much I'd love to say, Stacey. So I'll just a couple of, because you've raised so many interesting points through that. So the first thing is, one of the things that, you know, one of the things I heard you say was that you've noticed about yourself is that, like, the commentary inside your head, particularly in those earlier formative years, understandably came from the place where you heard commentary, which was from others, you know, coaches, parents, teammates, teachers, you know, whoever you cross paths with. And that's typically where our thinking is formulated from, you know, through what we're told and what we hear. And then we start to develop that internal dialogue, if you like. So I always talk about the fact that, you know, there's a voice inside our heads, and I always want to rest people's minds at ease that's supposed to be there. So if you've ever worried about the voice inside your head, then exhale, because it's okay. We're supposed to have that voice inside our head, and it's really functional, because what that voice is intended to do is to provide us with commentary on the world, to help us make decisions and to help us interact with the world, and determines how we feel emotionally, our confidence, our self-esteem, all those sorts of factors come together. One of the things I'm often working on with athletes is how you regulate that commentary. So, and I'm a big, big fan of, and this might be a helpful phrase for people to think about, is our self-talk. You talked before about sort of being all or nothing thinking. So what we would typically describe as having a very fixed mindset, you know, things are good or they're bad. I'm having no alcohol. I'm having lots of alcohol. Those sorts of things. And what we find that is generally more conducive to success is having a bit of flexibility in our thinking. You know, it's allowing us to. It doesn't have to be one or the other. It could be something in between. Because particularly when we're in achievement related settings like sport, or work, or family and relationships, we're growing and we're getting better and we're improving, which means by default, to get better, you have to make mistakes, because mistakes are such a good opportunity to learn. And if we make a mistake and then we go, oh, that's terrible, I made a mistake, I should never make a mistake, I should be perfect, we're actually setting ourselves up with limitations. So you mentioned my book, and I talk about it in there, the difference between what I would call a fixed mindset versus a performance mindset. Now, I know in some other areas you might see that described as a growth mindset. We're talking about the same thing. It just makes more sense to me to use the term performance, because I'm often working with sports athletes and corporates. To quickly round that off, because I think you've got another question for me, is what's really useful for us is, first of all, to be exactly as you've described it. Be curious about, what am I saying to myself? So it takes a level of mindfulness that you notice, hey, I just did this particular task. I went for a run this morning and told myself that I was too slow and I didn't do a very good job. So I noticed that I said that to myself. And then this is where I put my lens over the top of it, is rather than saying, well, the run was good or the run was bad, you know, the run was whatever the run was. Now what's helpful? And helpful with a question mark after it is what I aim to put across most of what I do. You know, you asked me before about my sons. So we might do something like Dylan and I driving the other day. It was not my finest moment when I was sitting there as the passenger. So afterwards, I took a breath. I did apologize to him before he got out of the car. I said, mate, that did not go the way I wanted it to. I said, we'll talk about it when you finish school, because I thought that at least gave me 6 hours to think about it. Not that I thought about it for 6 hours. But then, rather than me beating myself up as the parent who didn't get it right, I acknowledged that I was a parent who was doing her best and had a very human moment. And then I said to myself, okay, so what's helpful next time? What's helpful next time is that I might take a breath when he takes that corner a little bit quickly. What might be helpful is I might use some different phrasing as we approach a corner. You know, so I think sometimes when we acknowledge that we make mistakes, and we can say to ourselves, well, given that I just had that human moment, what's helpful now is one of the best things that you can do. So if you're an elite athlete or any kind of athlete, you can do that. You have your performance. It goes well, it doesn't go well, whatever it looks like, what's helpful now? You know, so I think that is probably a starting approach that I do with most of the athletes that I work with.
I just maybe put your mind at ease a bit with, when it comes to the driving. I drove one time with my mom, and that was the first and the last time we drove together. So when I was learning, from then on, I went with the driving instructor, because let's just say our driving experience also got a bit heated, because my mom was a very nervous driver, and she started freaking out from the moment we left the parking spot. So I think it's also that relationship that you have with the person does tend to make things like learning to drive a little bit more emotional than I think doing it with a driving instructor. So don't worry about it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Going with a professional. But it's interesting, Stacey, with the example that you gave, because there's a great sporting lesson as well, is that mood is contagious. You know, mood is contagious. So your mum, bless her, and I have great empathy to your mum right now hearing that story. But, you know, if your parent is nervous or your coach is anxious because you're getting to the back end of the season and we need to win this game, otherwise we're not going to get into the final that we want to, or if your teammate is worried because they've just made a mistake and they're worried about what's going to happen in the meeting on Monday, like whatever those circumstances can be, we're like sponges. And so we really need to have a bit of a, if we're not mindful, coming back to what I was talking about before, if we don't pay attention to what's happening around us, we can absorb a lot of that. And so then mum's anxiety becomes my anxiety. And then as I get anxious as I drive, as a learner driver, that's not helping mum. That's just putting her through the roof as well. So I think what a wise decision it was for you and for mum to go, actually, let's outsource this. So we can't quite do that in Australia. We have to do 100 hours here with our children. So,
okay.
So, well, we could do it. It would just be very, very expensive if I outsourced 100 hours of driving, but we're getting there.
Now that I think about it, part of the reason why I felt so nervous, I think it's because having mom there who's clearly giving off nervous energy. And then as soon as I jumped in the car with the driving instructor, he's been doing it for years and years and years. He's confident. He's calm. He's relaxed. He knows he can take control if he has to. So yeah, that's fascinating, that crossover, and talking about how emotional states can influence the people around you.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And Stacey, may I draw one last example out of that scenario that you gave, even though we didn't come on today to talk about driving lessons. But this is the point, isn't it, is that so many life circumstances draw itself back to the lessons in sport. The other thing the driving instructor had that your mum didn't have, I would guess, is a brake pedal. So a driving instructor typically in Australia, that their cars are set up that they can brake. The parent sitting in the front seat of the car does not have a brake. So what we actually surrender sitting in the front seat of the car alongside our children is we surrender control. And that's one of the other key things for athletes and for humans, is that when life feels out of control and unpredictable, it destabilizes us. So one of the reasons that we are anxious, I'll stick with my example, you're anxious potentially as the parent, the supervisor of the learner driver. It's not just that they've taken you within inches of death and then told you to chill out, which is what mine told me. But anyway, but it's also because you're losing control. Like the number of times I've sat in that seat and I've actually put my right foot out to brake on a pedal that isn't there, because you just do it by default. So a valuable lesson or thing to consider for anyone who's listening to us today can think about the role of control in your life. And particularly for an injured athlete, your control is taken away. You know, so there's so many instances in sport where we get challenged by that. And if we know that feeling out of control is challenging for us, then we can kind of acknowledge it and then hopefully put into place some strategies that help us to manage those situations better, because of course that's part of it, participating in life.
It really is amazing that the things that the crossovers in life, the connections are so broad. I mean, and as you said, you know, we're not here to talk about driving or things like that, but when you're talking about that destabilization, I'd mentioned to you that we'd just done a move on the weekend, so we're still unpacking things like that. But one of the big things that made me feel very stressed this weekend was because I felt as if I didn't have a lot of control over the situation, because I'm not in control of what the movers are doing, when they're arriving, what they're putting where. And that uncertainty really, really made me feel very uncomfortable. And I said to my wife, because she asked, she said, "You seem stressed." I said, "Yeah, because I'm not in control." So I thought that was fascinating that you mentioned that loss of control leads to sort of that destabilizing feeling and stress, which I felt quite hectically this weekend. And I'm not a stressful person. I'm normally very chilled.
And what's also helpful is that your wife is insightful enough to use her emotional intelligence to read what was happening for you. And she asked about it, because what could potentially happen in a situation like that is you don't ask, but then she starts to absorb some of the tension that she's picked up on. And the useful thing, Stacey, for you moving forward is, because, you know, things like moving house, it's exactly as you've described it. So if we know we're walking into a situation where some of our control is going to be taken from us, you know, like moving house is a good example, and there's probably a dozen others we can think of. If I know that I'm moving house next week, then I might know that I might need to employ some of my strategies that help me feel more in control in other areas. I might need to try and regulate how much sleep I have. I might need to make sure that I've eaten well that day. I might need to make sure you could do little things like go, okay, well, I'm going to organize takeaway for dinner that night. So at least, and the first thing we're going to do when we move is make my rule moving house is always to make my bed. It's the first thing that I do, because I figure out whatever else happens that day, at least I've got something to sleep in that night. You know, so it's how can I take control in an out of control situation, which I guess the reality for all of us is we've all had plenty of practice with that, because we've just been through a pandemic. You know, where so much was taken away from us in terms of control, and how can we find moments of control in our lives as we travel through unknown territory.
I'd like to bounce this off you, because I'm just wondering what you'd think. So I'm the kind of person, I like to get involved. So with the guys moving, I almost almost wish I could have jumped on the truck with him and helped him with the move, but obviously it's not my place. And being in South Korea, there's a bit of a language barrier as well. So I didn't want to get in their way. So eventually what I ended up doing is I asked my wife, it's okay if I can just go and grab some lunch because I hadn't eaten yet. I normally do a fast in the morning, so that's normal. So I took myself out of the situation basically, and I went down the road and just sat and had some lunch. And by the time I came back, the guys were almost finished. They were very quick and I felt much better. So I wonder is that running away from the problem? Is that not a good idea? Or is something like that just removing yourself from a situation where you know you can't exert control? Is that a helpful strategy?
You've just said the key word there right at the end. Because is that running away? No, that is removing yourself from the situation. And I would always come back at you and say, and was it helpful, Stacey? And you've already answered that and said, and it was really helpful. So, and it also sounds like you put in place all the mechanisms you needed to, as in you let your wife know what you were doing. So like if you'd just gone and hid in the backyard, then that might not have been so helpful. In, you know, like you let her know what you needed to do. It probably gave her a bit of space as well so that she could manage whatever she was doing at the particular point in time. So I always say to people that if you are wondering about whether you've made the right decision on something, you know, the best decision you could given the circumstances you were in, try asking yourself, was it helpful? And if the answer to it is yes, it was helpful in that particular moment, then there's a very good chance it was a great decision. You know, and if you come away from it and go, actually that wasn't helpful, like let's say for whatever reason that had rolled out a different way and you said that wasn't helpful, the next thing to do is go, okay, so where's the lesson in there? What where's the little piece of gold that I can be wiser about it next time? And the next time I end up in a situation like this, I'll try something else. So rather than go, you know, saying, well, that was unhelpful and therefore I am, and, you know, we say all these unkind things to ourselves, you know, what I've seen work really well for athletes and sporting teams is the understanding that in sport there's often a firm outcome. So you either win and have success or you learn a lesson, you know. And so either way, that's good, you know, because you'll be, you know, even from our losses, and I think of the two sporting teams I'm working with at the moment, one's just come off the back of a loss, one's just come off the back of a win. There's lessons for both teams in what's happened. And the wise thing, the helpful thing to do is to go, what was the lesson? Because if you won, you like that didn't just happen because you rocked up. It happened because of a whole range of things that you've put in place. Understand what they are so you can rinse it, repeat it, do it again. And if you lost, there's a lot of wisdom in that too. I wonder why, you know, what was it that caused that to happen? Learn from it so then you can adapt, change, and potentially put yourself in a better position to be successful next time. And that's a great way for any of us to travel through our experiences. What went well and where are the lessons?
Maybe we can dive into a little bit of the meat of the book, because I was happy to see the content of the book, especially the mindset part of it. And the reason why I say so is, trying to think if it was last year. No, it couldn't have been last year. It was either 2021 or 2020. I stumbled across Carol Dweck's work, which is the book Mindset. And honestly, that book and another book by a former Navy SEAL, which is Extreme Ownership, those two books together have honestly changed the way that I operate and the way that I think. And I almost want to say they should be recommended, or not recommended, they should be forced reading for kids that are going from like sort of the latter parts of high school, you know, 15, 16, 17, 18. So the reason being, the first book, Mindset, as Joe already mentioned, talking about changing that fixed mindset into a growth mindset or performance mindset, as you use, and maybe you can unpack that a bit when you have a chance. And then the second book was about taking ownership, which is something you alluded to when you were talking earlier about, I think it was about your experience with your son with driving, you know, talking about what could I do, and, you know, not just saying, okay, well, that's a failure and forget about it and don't take anything away from it, but actually having the accountability and asking yourself, what could I have done better? Is there something I can do and take ownership of that? So, you know, that growth mindset combined with that ownership and taking accountability, even sometimes in situations where the accountability doesn't seem like it lies on you, to ask yourself, is there something that I potentially could have done differently? Combining those two things together, I've just learned a huge amount about increasing performance. I'm a teacher as well in my day job. So I've taken that attitude into the classroom, and it definitely has rubbed off on the kids that I've taught as well, to try and show them that in Korea, unfortunately, because English isn't spoken a lot, there's a lot of English learning, but there's not a lot of English communication and practice. So kids learn basically how to ace a test. They write these extremely difficult English tests to get into universities, and they can barely speak a sentence or two to you outside of that, which is, so it's a very strange dynamic they have with the language. And a lot of them feel as if, well, I'm Korean. Some of them said, I'm Korean, so I can't speak English, or my English isn't good, I'm Korean. Essentially saying Korean people can't learn to speak English. And so that kind of attitude I've tried to change, because if you want to talk about fixed mindset, that is deeply, deeply fixed in its way of thinking. So yeah, could you maybe talk a bit about the difference between the fixed mindset and, as you call it, the performance mindset, and maybe how do you sort of coax that out of people? How do you get them to buy into it? Because it's one thing to say, right, you have a fixed mindset, but for the person with a fixed mindset, it might be very difficult to then transition out of the fixed mindset because they're stuck inside of it.
Yes, that's right. I mean, two great books for you to have read, Stacey. No, I'm not surprised at all that you kind of hold those close to your heart and say these have had a really strong influence on the way I think, the person I am. And then I'm feeling very fortunate for those students that you're teaching, because coming at your teaching, particularly as a profession, with those sorts of messages is really important for young people and young learners. And to your point about, well, what's the difference between that fixed and performance mindset? And let's keep it within the sort of the school examples, but this is something that all of the listeners can do, is think about, and this is often a question I like to pose, think about what your experience was like when you were at school in maths. And I usually find if I've got a room full of people here, I know straight away what it is, because I can tell by the looks on their faces. And I'll get a few souls in the room who will smile and they'll puff their chests out and they'll say, I was awesome at it. And then you'll get the majority of the group who will say, you know, I hated it, I was no good at it. And then you hear phrases like, a bit like you gave the example of your students, of, I just don't have a maths brain. It's just not the way that I think, you know, those sorts of elements. And so what we see is a jargon term we use in psychology is a thing called a self-fulfilling prophecy. So the self-fulfilling prophecy is, say, for example, I'm no good at maths, the Korean student who says, I can't learn English, the rugby league player who says, I'm no good at goal kicking, the basketballer who says, I can't take a three-pointer, you know. So there's a couple of different examples there. And what we know is that can't language, really, it's like it puts up an invisible brick wall around us and precludes us from doing it. So, and what happens is when we're nervous and we're anxious about that, it does affect our performance. So many years ago, when I have an academic position, I teach at a university here in Australia, and one of the subjects I used to teach a couple of subjects. One of them was sports psychology, and everyone always wanted to ask me about that. And at parties, no one ever wanted to ask me about the other subject that I taught in, which is research design and statistics. So I used to teach research design and statistics, and I always used to preface it to the students that I failed Maths 1 in high school. So in Australian high schools back then, there was a subject called Maths 1. It was the trickier of the math subjects, and over 2 years I failed it, like got 48%, I think, overall, which used to put a look of horror into the faces of the students who were sitting in my classroom and I'm about to teach them. But I used to say to them, so I know what it is to struggle in this subject. I know what it is to come into something and think, I'm not very good. And that I'm not very good language around it, understandably, what does that do? It increases our anxiety. It increases our worry. It means that every time we make a mistake, it's just further proof that we're no good at it. Whereas someone with a performance mindset is more likely to go, well, that's annoying. Why didn't that work that time? How can I try it in a different way? So what we see with a performance mindset is more curiosity around it. And to give the simplest example, the simplest strategy I can offer around shifting from a fixed mindset to a performance mindset is this, is to take that person who says, and I'm thinking of your Korean students as well, but I'll start with the maths one. I'm not good at maths, and all I want you to do is to add one word to it, and it's at the end. I'm not good at maths yet. So your Korean student, and I don't know how it would go with a Korean student, so I'm making things up here, Stacey. You can tell me whether this is a good, but you know, it's I'm not good at English yet. And what the yet word does is it gives us the potential for improvement. And that's all you need. You just need the recognition that if I chose to, and if the right person helped me, and if I had the right, you know, lessons and learnings and teaching, is it possible that I could be better at English, better at maths, better at the three-point shot, better at goal kicking? It is. We just need the courage to not be very good at the start. You know, I've got lots of phrases that I love, and one of them is that every expert was once a beginner. You know, if you think about the top athlete in the sport that you love the most, and then go back to when they were four or they were five, they probably weren't very good, but they stuck at it, they persevered. You know, we often talk a lot about, and it's something that often comes up in with the teams that I work with, is the notion of grit, G-R-I-T, grit. And what is that? You know, and it's really when I think when you combine perseverance with passion for something. But some of the best athletes, it's not so much what happens to them when they have a disappointment, but it's how they respond to it that becomes critical in terms of whether they're going to grow. You know, I can put my hand on my heart and say, I'm not particularly good at pole vault. Okay. And that's because I think I tried it once when I was about 14, and I'm a lot older than that now, and I haven't practiced it. So it's probably true. And I'm not very good at it. And if I felt so inclined, I could probably get some coaching, and I'm sure that I would improve at it. So it's that recognizing the potential for growth. And sometimes for someone who is really sort of digging their heels in and saying, no, this is me, I'm just no good at it, I'm not a maths person, or I'm never going to learn English other than to do this test or whatever it is, sometimes it might be about seeing other role models do it, or sometimes it might be trying to have a conversation around that barrier that people are putting in their own way about why you're not prepared to put yourself out there. Because, you know, setting yourself goals is all about taking risks, because you may not get it right every time, but it's about being kind to yourself and forgiving yourself, learning, dusting yourself off, and then having another go.
And what makes it even more interesting, I think, in the Korean context is there is definitely a version of making mistakes in front of your peers. So saving face, which is a very prevalent thing here, it doesn't help when you're trying to encourage students to learn something new because, as you said, you have to make mistakes. Well, you don't have to make mistakes. Obviously, if you are naturally good at something, you might not make mistakes initially, and then as you advance and become better, you might run into more complex things and then make mistakes. But I guess the idea of being comfortable with mistakes is something that in the Korean context is quite difficult to make them understand. For example, if a student tries to speak English but isn't overly good, then sometimes you'll hear a lot of the other students laughing at them. And then obviously that shatters someone's confidence because they don't want to be laughed at every time they speak. And so trying to make other students understand that they shouldn't really laugh because at least they're trying is also been very interesting. And one of the things that sort of rung a bell for me, using the word yet, that small word, is so powerful. I kind of did it in a little bit of a different way, and I wonder if it has the same effect. Maybe you can tell me. I would say something like, well, what is your favorite subject? What are you best at? And oftentimes it's math in Korea, or it's science, or one of those things. And I said, when you were 5 years old, were you as good at math now as you were then? And then you can see the wheels start to turn. And then I would say, well, that's exactly the same with English. But with math, you've had way more practice, and that's why your math has improved, but your English is still coming along. I would never say that's why your English isn't good. I would say things like, well, that's why your English is still catching up, or something like that.
That's a great strategy. And I was saying before, you know, you can look to role models, but what better role model than ourselves? So if you if you were able to have that conversation with them. And I guess what I really appreciated with that example that you gave, Stacey, is that cultural influence is so incredibly strong. And obviously here we're talking about a national cultural element but it speaks to any organisation or any team is, and I guess I'm thinking of sporting teams, the sporting teams that allow their athletes to have a go and to make a mistake, and mistakes are okay because it's a sign of progress. That's what we see. And like you say, if you're trying to reinforce that in a place where, you know, like if you spent, I don't know, how is this a class, do you have them all day every day, or is this high school where they might have you for an hour each?
I have them at middle school, and unfortunately I only see them about an hour a week, so it's quite limited.
Yeah, so for that hour a week, they're in a safe place where you give them permission to be vulnerable, and you might be the only person who does that in their entire week. So it makes sense, doesn't it? And I think that was one of the things I learned on my campaign last year with the Orchids, is that, you know, it was such a good reminder for me, is that the culture of the group that you are with, whether it be their ethnic culture, whether it be their organisational culture, whether it be, you know, the demographic of whatever that might be, is so strong, and we do need to encourage that. And I guess you just do that in ways that you can, you know, and finding ways to encourage and reward effort. And this is probably one of the reasons that I'm not a teacher, because I instantly in my head thought, right, well, I know that I would have a bag of lollies in my desk, and every time someone was brave enough to have a go and potentially make a mistake, I'd give them lollies. So, that's why I'm not a teacher. So there's probably better strategies than what I'm suggesting. But, you know, it's that recognising or rewarding that bravery, and that's a challenging thing that, you know, I'm glad that those students get that hour with you each week, where at least they've got someone who's opening them up to that possibility.
Yeah, one of the things I try to do from the very outset, I've always been a very self-assured person, so making a fool out of myself has never been a problem for me, and not necessarily on purpose, but doing things that open myself up to being criticized, or being laughed at or being embarrassed about. I think it might have been from a young age, I had to deal with people making fun of my name all the time. And I just always, instead of pushing back against them, I always try to find ways to kind of laugh with them. And I never really was embarrassed about it. And I think I adapted and always made it part of my persona to not really get embarrassed about things like that. And so what I do in the classroom is I try to be a little bit silly at times. I try and use a bit of the Korean language to show them, like, I don't have an idea of what I'm doing with their language. If we're playing a game that encourages speaking, I'll do something silly with that to show them, like, look, right, this is not a stuffy, serious environment. This is an environment where it's casual, and if you make fun of yourself, that's fine. It's okay to laugh, but not laugh sort of at the person's level, but rather laughing at more of their actions and the things that they're doing rather than their ability to speak English. I've been teaching it for now 3 years. So I've kind of had to learn different strategies to try and get it right. And the difficulty about being in a forced school environment is disinterest. So I found it very difficult to trying to espouse that kind of growth mindset in students who are just literally disengaged from the educational process, that are there because they have to be there rather than wanting to be there. And it's really sad, because as someone who's only there an hour a week with them, there's so little that I feel I can do in that time that I have with them to change that attitude. And I wonder, the crossover with sports, you know, you've got in a professional environment, I'm hoping that most of the guys are there and girls are there because they want to be there. So maybe that's something you don't run into. But I was wondering, for like younger sports people, that, you know, your high school students, things like that, in South Africa, there's, when I was at school, it was compulsory for kids to play sports as part of a healthy lifestyle. How would you go about encouraging a growth mindset in someone who just doesn't want to be there, who's like, I'm only here because I have to be here. I don't want to be here. I'm not a rugby player, I'm not a cricket player, but I have to because I'm forced to be here. How do you think about that conversation with someone like that?
Yeah, I think you captured a big part of it earlier when you said, you know, you talked about silliness and you explained that in a way that it's not about being silly per se, but what you talked about is it sounds fun. It sounds enjoyable. And when I've worked, even with elite athletes, when they're getting to the back end of their career perhaps, and if they do have that luxury of deciding when they finish their sporting career, which the majority of athletes, particularly elite athletes, do not, most of it, it's decided for them. When so it hasn't been a lot of athletes that I've encountered with it, but those who've maybe stayed a year longer than they needed to, you know, maybe it would have been better if they'd retired a year earlier. And it becomes a drudge. And, you know, most of us hear that and go, oh, gosh, you know, how could that possibly be the case? It would just be the best thing to do ever. And the reality of it is there's a lot of really non-glamorous moments about being, you know, the early mornings, the hard work, the late trainings. Here in North Queensland where I am, it's quite tropical, you know, it's hot, you know, all those kinds of factors. So I think that the challenge for people is when the motivation, it doesn't feel like the motivation is there, or there's less connection with the activity and why they're doing it, that fun element can be a way to get them through. Perhaps it might be about helping them to understand, okay, I know this isn't what you want to do, but this is a chance for you, you know, there's other gains for you to get from this, or what that might look like. But I think also acknowledging for some people that this is tough. I mean, that's, you know, I made that little joke about teaching research design and statistics to second year students. Now, most people don't walk into a psychology degree because they want to do statistics. Like, that's typically not why they enrolled. And some don't even know they have to do it until they land in your lecture theatre in second year. So there can be a lot of resistance, a lot of apprehension and worry and self-doubt and so forth. So I think just trying to connect with people and just say, look, let's think about why you're here. And the reality is, you may, as a school student, you can't control whether you're there or not. If the school says thou shalt play water polo, then thou shalt play water polo, or, you know, whatever the sport is. But it's, again, because what are we doing? Taking the control away from them, which is what we were talking about earlier, is the thing that we don't like. So connecting with people, acknowledging where they're at, I think all of those things can be helpful. And then just finding ways, you know, because the reality of life is there's lots of things that we do every day, every week, that we don't necessarily like or want to do. So it's a life skill to be able to do those things as well. And school is a good grounds for us to learn some of those things.
Perfect. One of my questions that I wanted to ask you today was linked to your research and what your most interesting finding was throughout the research, maybe specifically in the book that you sent me, The Elite. And I can't imagine that it wouldn't have happened, but as a researcher studying those things, did it change something about the way that you thought about the topics that you discussed? And if so, what is the biggest thing or the most surprising thing that you took away and actually yourself have applied, be it as a mom or be it as a psychologist or be it as a working professional?
Great question. So for those that are less familiar with the book, essentially what it is I share the 10 key lessons that I've learnt in my career from working with elite athletes. And what I've aimed to do there is translate it so that anyone could read them, and then you could pick up the little specks of gold, if you like, or the little hopefully nuggets of gold, maybe a bit bigger than a speck, that you might then be able to apply in your own life. So it's not a straight sports psychology book. That is actually the next one that I'm writing. That will be. But this one is more about what are the lessons that I've learned and how can we apply it. So there were essentially there's 10 chapters that speak to each of those 10 key lessons. But if I was going to pick one of them, and I must say that I consider myself a work in progress. I'm constantly trying to grow as a person and learn lessons and hopefully share some of those lessons with the people that I work with and the people that I live with and who want to hear them. One of the chapters that I think speaks to a topic that people have a lot of familiarity with but maybe not from this particular angle is the chapter on gratitude. So gratitude has had a lot of airplay, particularly in the last couple of years. So, you know, most people when I go into a workshop or talk to a group, you know, they're expecting me to say that gratitude is a bit of a winner. And we certainly know that's the case. So just if I was going to capture that in a nutshell, what we know is that of the two things that are most likely to bring you happiness, one of them is gratitude. So we know that humans who are, you know, if you instantly want to increase your level of happiness with the world, then find ways to be grateful for the world that you live in. And it can be little things like, so this morning I had a really nice coffee and I didn't even have to make it. A barista made it for me and it was just the right temperature and it was lovely. So if I spend a little moment just going, how good was that? You know, then it feels good to think about things that we're grateful for, to notice those things. So gratitude is one of those things. And here in Australia, gratitude has a lot of press. And certainly within our education systems, thankfully, and in our workplaces, the benefits of gratitude are particularly reinforced in terms of how it impacts for us in terms of well-being and happiness. So that is enough of a reason in and of itself for any one of us at the end of each day to go, what went well today? What am I grateful for? You know, moving house is a challenging time for us and tiring and all the rest of it, as you said. But isn't it good that now that we're in a house where we feel settled and I know people listening can't see it, but I did see a very cute cat just walk behind you before, Stacey. So, yes. You know, so your pet's obviously settled in and, you know, I'm assuming that's your pet, otherwise a random cat's yes. in your house. So gratitude is useful for us from that perspective. But the thing that I think we haven't seen as much writing about or speaking about, but I'd really love to share with those who are listening, is that we also know that gratitude is a performance enhancer. So I'll say that again. Gratitude is a performance enhancer. So grateful athletes, grateful teams, grateful organizations, grateful classrooms of students, people who are grateful tend to perform better. Now, the mechanism behind that isn't fully known. But one of the things that I would say, so this is a world according to Joe. So this is just a Joe theory. So that I haven't got the evidence to back behind it, but I don't think I'm too far off the mark, is I think one of the reasons that gratitude helps us to enhance our performance is I almost describe gratitude when we're being grateful, it's a relaxing thing to do. Like you don't typically, you know, have you ever met someone who's grateful and anxious at the same time? You probably haven't, you know. So, those two things don't go hand in hand. Gratitude goes hand in hand with being appreciative, with being happy. It's a relaxing thing to do. So I almost describe it like, and this is not a very much a technical term, but please go with me on this, that gratitude for me in a performance setting is almost like a psychological sigh where we kind of go, that's good. And so what happens is in most performance settings, we perform at our best when there is a degree of relaxation to what we're doing. So if I'm just about to be, I'm at work and I've got to give a presentation, you know, I could walk into that and be really nervous and that would probably impact on my performance. Or I could be grateful for the opportunity that people trusted me enough to give this talk, to share this information. And I don't know, maybe afterwards I'm going to take myself off to the bakery and buy myself a little treat for being so brave, or, you know, how good is that? You know, what do all my examples come back to food, Stacey? I'm not sure. So when we're grateful, it sets us up to perform well. The team that, you know, and I, if I can give one quick example from the World Cup with the Orchids last year, and this is the Women's National Rugby League team from Papua New Guinea. We were so fortunate. We were able to put together a really professional campaign for the team to go to the World Cup. And most of the players had never left PNG, let alone put on a puffer jacket, gone to England in the middle of winter and played in a World Cup. But if you compared their last campaign at the last World Cup to this time, and it's a growth and the teams are changing and opportunities change. But when they played at the last World Cup, they were given old jerseys and they were men's jerseys. Mm-hmm. So a man's jersey doesn't fit well on a woman. Now, and at the time, no one complained. How good is it that we get to play for PNG and wear this jersey? 4 years later, we take them to the World Cup in custom-made women's size-fitting jerseys. Now, it's a small thing, but they were so grateful. And it's funny, I still get goosebumps when I think about it, because they were so proud to represent their country and they knew they looked good and they felt good. And when they stood there and they sang the national anthem, they stood there and what they felt was overwhelming gratitude. And when we I supported them to work out the team values for the team for the campaign. And, you know, I won't divulge those because they're confidential within the team. But what I can very comfortably say is a big part of that is a top pissin word, which is the national language that's used in PNG, which is a word called hamamas. And hamamas is the top pissin word of gratitude with joy. And is there a better word? I don't think there is. Gratitude with joy. So those women stood with hamamas on the field. You know, they were stunning jerseys. They fitted them well. They stood tall. They sang their anthem for their country. And what better way to start off a World Cup game than that kind of setting? So the gratitude piece is one that I'm a big fan of. It's good for us just as humans in terms of enhancing our well-being. But it's also something you can lean into and draw upon to help you with your performance.
I find it quite disturbing sometimes. I notice that with the modern world and all the technology, I find myself, just going back to your coffee example, I find myself being disconnected from those small little pleasures so often because I'm grabbing my phone to read a message while sipping my coffee. And something I've become a lot more intentional about is those kinds of small things. So when I go to eat food, I always try to put my phone away. When I drink coffee, I try to actually sit and enjoy it. I mean, it's hard to explain the differences, to put it into words, but it makes a huge difference, just even on a small scale like that. And I think gratitude goes hand in hand with mindfulness and awareness. You have to be present in the moment, to enjoy the moment, to be grateful for it. It's very difficult to express gratitude if you're not being present with what you're currently doing. So I think I started meditating many years ago, but I've already started taking it seriously towards the back end of last year. And through building that awareness, I think it's gone hand in hand with being more comfortable with putting the phone away and I'm not using it as a crutch anymore. Yeah, so it's fascinating that gratitude holds such a high place amongst all the things that you speak about, but it does make sense.
Absolutely, and I appreciate what you said there, Stacey, because gratitude requires the authenticity of being mindful. So I think that makes a really big difference. Like you said, because otherwise it just becomes tokenism, and we say these things. So if people are saying, you know, well, you know, I'm not really into a gratitude journal, or, you know, maybe I've got no one to sit around the table with at night and say what I'm grateful for. I mean, there's lots of ways that you can do that. But I hope this sounds okay when I phrase it like this, but one of the best ways to be more grateful is just to stop. Now, maybe I don't know if I'm about to give you an Australian expression, but you just stop whinging. Stop complaining. Like, I think whinging is an Australian term, but I think you nodded, so I'm thinking you know what I mean. But it's that notion, you've never met a grateful complainer. Like, they don't go hand in hand. So if you're mindful and you can hear yourself saying, oh, this weather today, it's terrible, and I had to wait for behind three people in the coffee line, and then now I've forgotten my charger and I can't get my phone working for me, and I'm not happy that I've got to do, you know, like, that does not sound like gratitude to me. So if you can, and look, we all do it. I complain too. Absolutely, I complain too. What I do, though, is when I catch myself complaining, I pull myself up and then I go, Joe, you're not sounding very grateful right now. So that usually pulls me up fairly short because I know how important it is. And so then I have a little inhale, exhale, and I try and reframe what I'm saying.
And that's why I love having these conversations, because you're linking so much of what I already think, but you're kind of forming new connections for me. I've also become quite big into practice of stoicism. So, and that's very much, you don't try to avoid complaining about things, especially those things that you can't control. So one of the examples you use is, oh, well, the weather's horrible today. And then that kind of then rolls onto the neck. Oh, now I have to drive and the roads are wet, and kind of spirals out of control. And so I'm wondering if that move away from complaining, which I've done quite intentionally as well, has also made the process of going through the gratitude a little bit easier for me. My brother and my sister, the three of us, we have a group on WhatsApp, and all we do in there is every day we mention something that we're grateful about. And sometimes it feels a little bit like forced and cringy and whatever, but most times it is something that I really feel grateful for. And what it's made me realize is there are things that seem so trivial that I'm extremely grateful for. I mean, I don't know if silly is the right word, but one example that I would use is like access to water and electricity, something that is so ubiquitous across the modern world. I sometimes will sit and think, South Africa right now, a good example, is going through a very bad electricity crisis. There's a lot of, they have to turn the power off for hours at a time. And it's just, I think what I've noticed about being grateful is it starts making you think about the things that are just so quote unquote normal that we just expect to have on a day-to-day basis. I'm all aboard the gratitude train and thank you for sharing that.
Yes, aboard the gratitude train and off the complain train.
That's certainly something that I look back on now, especially I think in my 20s, I wasn't too good at catching myself complaining. And I think I did a lot of complaining and now thankfully a bit better at it. From working with athletes and the military, you're dealing with people where performance is expected. So there's a rugby match coming up that they have to win to progress in a cup, or for military, maybe there's a mission that they have to execute on. What do you think is the biggest sort of roadblock in the way of people's thinking that stops them, that hinders them from achieving high level performance?
Mm-hmm.
Is it difficult to say because it depends on the individual? I'm not sure.
Look, it is. I was just thinking that I did this mental sweep of like, say, the last 15 athletes I've spoken to see if I can pull out a common element. And I think it does vary. I do think it's in very much an individualized thing, but I do think common for many, you know, some of those mindset things that we've already talked about, you know, and self-doubt particularly can be one. But I think particularly when I'm looking at performance enhancement, what are some of those key predictors of high performance? And the more recent book that I've had come out is a book called The Game Plan, which is, it's actually more of a journal than a book, but I've got some QR codes to video links in it and so forth. But the essence of that book is I look at five key pillars for high performance and what they look like, and then you can go sort of through a journal trip, if you like, or a journal journey, through those elements to work on those skills and developing those. And at the risk of spoiling what the first 2 months are, and, you know, people will lean into this and go, oh, what are the five key predictors of high performance? You know, they must be really complicated and, you know, psychologically based and all the rest of it. And I wish it was something really tricky and fancy, but here's where I tell you something you already know. And my question to you is, how well are we as humans doing it? And the two biggest predictors of high performance is rest and fuel. How well rested are you, and what's your fuel like? Like, if you want to get the most bang for your buck in terms of, you know, performing well, before you start with any of the, you know, I've got all those tips and tricks in the Elite. There's 10 chapters of them. But the starting point is actually what I talk about in The Game Plan, which is, you know, how well did you sleep last night? How well have you slept over the last week? What are your strategies around rest and recovery? And are you fueling your body? Because decision-making is really influenced by both of those two factors. And I go into it in a bit more detail and I talk about the research in that, but essentially that's where the gold is. So I think that often some of those fundamentals that we know about, and if you're sitting there going, yeah, I know that, that's great. How well are you going with it? Because most humans probably could be doing those things better. And if I share a piece of research that people may not know about, but this was actually some research conducted with teenage athletes a number of years ago, and I often quote this back to teenage athletes when I'm standing in front of them, because, having two of my own, I've got a pretty good idea how they think. But this particular piece of research looked at sleep and teenage athletes. And what they found is that those athletes who averaged under 7 hours sleep a night increase their risk of injury over the next 21 months by 70%. And often the kids, when I'm speaking to them, they'll go, Did you say 7 or did you say 70? I said 7-0. So averaging under 7 hours sleep a night increased your risk of injury over the next 21 months by 70%. So then I say to them, do you want to know how to reduce your risk of injury? And, of course, teenage athletes will say yes. And I'll go, okay, so here's some advice. It's 3 words. It's complicated, so you're going to have to listen really, really hard. Are you ready? And they all go, yes. And I go, here it is. Go to bed. And then I pause and I say, go to bed. And then I say, who do I sound like? And they go, you sound like my mum. And I go, I know, more bad news. She's right. Go to bed, you know. And for many of us, like, we know that. But, you know, we might know that. But at 9 o'clock at night, are we flicking through our phones looking at, you know, cat videos on some social media channel? Or are we putting the phone down and putting it away? Are we, you know, doing a bit of reading or some stretching or some meditating or just having a bed routine that sets us up well for sleep? So I guess if I was going to share with the listeners, and I know, I'm sorry that it's not fancy and I'm sorry it's not complicated, but get those two things right and then you can do all the fancy stuff and then you can read the Elite and pick up the other 10 tips.
It's so frustrating. I do a lot of weight training. I've actually competed twice on the bodybuilding stage, which my listeners will know about. And I run into the same kinds of things when I speak to people about their health and fitness. And everyone's looking for the silver bullet. Everyone wants to know, what supplements should I take? Is there something I can, you know, it's always, I find it strange, it's always the pills that people, or the powders that people want to turn to because they think there's something that they can get there that they would otherwise not. And I always, my first two questions to people that are wanting to improve their health is, what is your sleep like? And what is your diet like? And it's so interesting because you always get the same reaction. You always get a bit of a groan, kind of like, oh, well, you know, I'm not, like, I know I don't sleep enough. I know my diet could be better. And it's like, well, right, let's get those two things right first. And then let's start talking about, I mean, that's the word. The word supplement means a small little add-on that you incorporate in as part of a holistic program of health.
In the apple tree, you want to reach for the low-hanging fruit. You know, there's stuff there right in front exactly. of you that will make a really big difference. And I'm like you, you know, I'd take the pill too if you could offer it to me and say, look, this pill will make you feel rested and be nutritionally sound for you and all the rest of it, but it just doesn't exist. And we can do it ourselves. It's just that, I guess it's, again, it's that reminder, it's that awareness. And the other thing that happens is, you know, it's not always our fault, because at the end of the day, I don't know about you, Stacey, but for me, for most of the people I know, I'm tired by the end of the day. So that's why decision making, you know, if I'm lying on the couch watching TV at the end of the day, it's much easier to hit play next episode on Netflix than it is for me to get up, turn off the lights, put the cat out, you know, lock up the house and go to bed. Like, so we do tend to lean into what's easier. And that's why, you know, you're not always going to feel motivated. So you need to be disciplined. And when you're not always going to be disciplined, you need to have habits, because it's the habits that we lean back into and they're the things that set us up for success. So when we can build sleep, when we can build fuel, when we can build physical training in as part of our daily habits, we don't have to think about it so much. And these things are a bit more automated, a bit like brushing your teeth.
That's cool that you went that way, because I wanted to actually next ask you, sort of maybe before we wrap up, we can talk a bit about habits, and then thank you so much for giving up so much of your time. We can call it a day. One of the things that jumped out to me as well, talking about habit and getting into good routines, I found personally, and maybe you can share your experience as well, the environment that you put yourself into also seems to dictate a lot of what we do. So, and I think I'm not anti-technology. I love technology. It's done wonderful things. But one of the examples you used there was talking about Netflix and how the Netflix system is literally geared towards you watching another episode rather than it is geared towards you turning off after one. I mean, that little countdown time in the bottom right goes like 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 before the credits have even finished and you're into the next episode. So just get your opinion on environment and environment design. That's something that I'm very big on. So when I sit down to work, I try to remove as many of the distractions as possible. And then when it comes to habits and routines, could you also share a bit about the power of habits? I know you speak about that quite extensively in your book, and how people can kind of combine environment and habits to try and produce better performance or better results in their work. I know that we're speaking mostly about sports, but as we've said, it does cross over massively into everyday life as well.
Yeah, it absolutely comes across into everyday life. And I am such a big fan of habits. And I guess a couple of things I say about habits to anyone who will listen to me when I speak about it is, you know, I think we make as humans so many decisions on any given day. You know, it's speculated, and this is speculation, but it's speculated it's around 30 to 40,000 decisions every single day. So decisions you don't even know you're making. You know, while we've been talking, Stacey, and you've been talking and I've been not talking, you know, I've probably had 6 drinks out of my water bottle. Now, that's a decision. I don't even know if it's 6 times, but, you know, I'm not even aware that I'm making those decisions, but they're the decisions that we make. I'm currently sitting here holding a pen in my hand. I don't even know why I'm holding a pen. I'm not writing notes. So I'm talking to you, you know. So we're making decisions all of the time. And I say to people that what we do is, because we're making so many decisions, there's too much stuff to think about. Like, most of us don't lie in bed in the morning and really agonize over when you brush your teeth this morning. Are you going to hold the toothbrush with your left hand or your right hand? You know, you don't give it that thought. It's not worth it. You just get up, you go to the sink and you brush your teeth. So the reason we don't think about it is that's been automated for us. Chances are the hand you use to brush your teeth is the same one you've used as long as you can remember. So I say to people that habits are great because they save us from having to think. But what we've also got to be careful of is that habits are terrible because they save us from having to think. So if my habit is that I get on the couch at night and I binge a whole series of something on Netflix, then, well, I mean, no judgment on people who do and really enjoy it. That's great. If you enjoy it, fabulous. Is it helpful? Yes, perfect. For me, it's not helpful. For me, it's not helpful because I'm an early riser. That's when I do my physical activity. So it doesn't serve me well to watch 6 episodes of something on Netflix. Doesn't mean I can't watch one. That might be a nice way for me to unwind at the end of the day, or I might read a book, or I might just listen to some music, whatever it's going to be. So being mindful about our habits, I think, is really important, because some of our habits, let's look at it through that lens again, some of our habits are helpful and some of our habits are less helpful. And we just want to, you know, put more time into the things that are helpful and maybe tweak and change the things that are less so. So you're right. I'm a big fan of habits because they're the ones that kind of take it out of our thinking space, and we can automate a lot of those behaviors. We just want to spend some time thinking about which behaviors serve me best, and are there ways that I can create habits out of those so that I can get on with my life and use my brain to think about some of the more complex tasks in my life. So the time probably doesn't enable us to talk about it today, but if people are interested, they can read it in the book. I've taken a really simple example, like flossing your teeth, and most people, when I talk to a room full of people and I start talking about flossing their teeth, I can see tongues moving inside mouths as people try and floss their teeth with their tongues because they didn't do it this morning. Like, if you didn't floss your teeth this morning when you brushed your teeth, you know, don't be too hard on yourself. 89% of the population don't. About 11% of the population floss according to what dentists recommend. So, and it's not because we don't know it's a good habit. It's a good thing for us to do. We just, for whatever reason, don't. So I take something as simple as flossing your teeth and outline that in the book and show how you can automate it. And what I would always say about habits, a bit like you were talking about before, is start small. Don't take on the whole world and, you know, try to fix everything at once. You know, journalists don't always like it when they contact me in December and they say, you know, Joe, we want to do a story on New Year's resolutions. Can you help our readers or our listeners get better at it? And I say, at the risk of sounding a little pessimistic, most people fail at their New Year's resolutions. In fact, I'd rather do a story with you about why they're not that great an idea and what you can do instead. You know, so I think habits are a really important part of our lives. We can use some of the strategies to form habits to get us closer to our goals, and that's always worthwhile for us to do. So, yeah, I guess the main thing I would say is reinforce that I think habits are incredibly important. There's some really easy little life hacks that you can put in place to help you reinforce your habits. And so reading in that space, and there's lots of authors that write in that space. You'll find it in The Elite, but you'll find it in lots of other resources as well, podcasts, those sorts of things. And, I've got a couple of links on my website that talk about it in very briefly, but our conversation probably as much as anything reinforces the importance of habits for people.
Okay, great. Before we wrap up, I just have one follow-up question on that. And if it is too long-winded an answer, it's fine. You don't have to answer. I was wondering, why is it that we fail at habits regardless of knowing that they are good for us? So a good example for me, it took me a very, very long time to build up a habit of drinking enough water. I don't know why, but from a young age, I just never really enjoyed drinking water. So I've never had problems with dehydration or anything like that. And I get a lot of water, I guess, from the food that I eat and from drinking tea. So I like tea and coffee and those kinds of things. Yes, I know that there's a slight diuretic effect as well, but I guess you're getting more water than you are losing water. So why is it that people seem to struggle with building habits? And then if we can sort of round up on that, that would be great.
Yeah, so great question. Water consumption is not a problem in my neck of the woods because it's really hot in North Queensland. So we talk about how many litres we drink each day. I probably drink 4 litres of water every day. But exactly to your point, why do I think most people don't form the habits that get them where they want to be? It's because people are busy and because people are tired. Now, people are well-intentioned. So you talked about having a good intention and so good intentions are not enough. They're a great start. A good intention is always a great start. Being educated about it and understanding that water is good for the body, that's a great start. But on a day when we're tired and fatigued and it's not part of our everyday, then it doesn't occur to us. And I'm a big fan of tripping over your habits. So what I mean by that is, you want to make it as easy for yourself to get closer to your goal rather than further away from it. So if we went with a completely unrelated example and said, I would like to get better at playing the guitar, if that was a goal that somebody had, then I would say to that person, put that guitar in your lounge room and lean it up against your coffee table. Do not put it in its case in the back bedroom up in the cupboard. Because what we need to do is we need to make it easier. I had someone, it was one of the soldiers that I worked with in one of our courses, who said, Joe, I'm so hit and miss with my medication. Some days I remember, some days I forget. This is like really important. Like my health is at risk if I don't take this and I still don't do it. So there's a motivated person. Now, the reason they weren't taking it is it wasn't occurring to them in the busyness of their morning. So what we did is we connected it. We essentially set them up to trip over it in that what we did is we created a mental link for them, if you like, between taking the medication, something that they weren't doing reliably, with something they were doing reliably, which was pressing the button on their coffee machine each morning. So it became when I press the button on my coffee machine, and they must have had a fancy coffee machine because it took a good 30 seconds for the cup of coffee to come out of the machine. You know what you can do in 30 seconds? In 30 seconds, you can walk across to your fridge, get the medication out, put it on the bench and pour a cup of water. You know, so what happened then, and I worked with this person as part of a group for 4 weeks, and, you know, every time I saw them, I'd say, how are your medication going? And, you know, they started off really proud because they were taking their medication every single day because they were drinking coffee. By the fourth week, and I'd say to them, how's your medication going? They almost looked at me like they were annoyed at me because why is this even a thing? Because of course I take my tablets now. So they'd gone from being someone who was really unreliable with it to, why are you even asking me about this, Joe? Why is this even, like, I'm a pill taker. You know, I do my medication. So, yeah, I think that's probably I don't think that was the short answer you were looking for, Stacey, but I think that's
it's great.
A big part of it.
I love it when people unpack and go into depth. I'm just mindful of your time. A lot of what you've said about habits today are very much outlined in a book called Atomic Habits by James Clear.
Mm.
And I think it's fascinating that you mentioned there about the person getting annoyed. you're describing, essentially describing an identity change, going from I'm not a pill taker to I'm the person that takes my pills every day. And that's something that really opened my eyes after reading Atomic Habits, was that a lot of people look at the habit as an outcome. So I want to drink more water, but you should rather make it something like, I am somebody who drinks a lot of water. And in that shift of language is a massive difference. So it's interesting that the person kind of went through that process organically and became annoyed by being asked about the question.
Yeah, I did point out the change, and that's what I did. When it happened, I laughed and said, you're going to shake your head at me, aren't you? Like, you know what question's coming. They said, yes, yes. And I said, can you see who you are now? You know, because and it's that doesn't come from a fixed mindset. A fixed mindset is the person who I'm unreliable with my medication. Whereas, you know, I'm reliable with my medication is a big shift in the mindset. So it takes that willingness to do it and the bravery to do it as well.
Awesome. Joe, could I ask you to share, where can people find your books? Where can they find your research? If people want to dig deep into the research side of things, you can throw out all the resources, because, you know, I think different people will gravitate towards different kinds of content. So where can we find you and learn more about what you do?
Where can you find me? Okay, thank you, Stacey. Thank you for that opportunity. So the key thing is that if you can remember my name, you can find me. So I travel under all my platforms. It's under my name, which is Dr. Dr. Joe, J-O, Lukins, L-U-K-I-N-S. So you'll find me on Facebook and LinkedIn, Instagram, although my 16-year-old says my Instagram profile is horrible, so ignore him. What would he know? What would he know? He can't even drive yet. I'm going to be in so much trouble when he listens to this. So you can find me on all of those platforms. I've got 3 books out at the moment, which is The Elite, Think Like an Athlete, Succeed Like a Champion. I've got my book In the Grandstands, which is Surviving the Triumphs and Tears of Teenage Sports. So it's definitely a book for parents. And then my third book that came out last year is called The Game Plan. I've actually got a bundled book of The Game Plan and The Elite that's going to be coming out from, I think, next week. And I'm about 50% of the way through writing my next book, which is actually going to be a sports psychology book. So it's going to be specifically designed as ad athletes. So you can find those now. You can get them through my website, and I can distribute those internationally if it comes through the website, or you can find me through all the normal channels for getting hold of books. I can, if I may, recommend your local independent bookseller. I'm a big fan of supporting independent booksellers, because they're just little businesses that are trying to share knowledge. But of course, if you also like to get your books, etc., from the larger corporations, they all have them as well. The Elite, I have all the books as ebooks, and The Elite, I also have it as an audio book as well. So so lots of places you can find me, but reach out on one of the platforms. And if there's something that you're looking for, I've got some courses coming out in the next couple of weeks, as well as some online courses and things. So there's lots of ways to find out more information if you're curious to know a little bit more about how to develop high performance thinking.
Thank you so much, Joe. I'm really, really appreciative of you giving up your time. And as I always say, I learned so much today, and I really appreciate you connecting some ideas for me, and hopefully through the process of our conversation, other people can connect some dots for themselves.
Thank you, Stacey, and I'm also very grateful for the opportunity to chat with you today.
As we come to the end of this episode of Speaking to Stacey, I want to say a big thanks for listening all the way through. I hope that you have found some valuable insights from my conversation with Dr. Joe Lukins. Before you go, I have a couple of favors to ask. Please remember to subscribe to Speaking to Stacey. That way you'll never miss new episodes. And if you enjoyed this conversation, please leave a rating and a review. It helps others to find the show. Remember, the more the show grows, the easier it is for me to continue to bring you beneficial content. In next week's show, I have a big announcement to make, so please tune in to find out more. I hope you've enjoyed the show today, and look forward to sharing this experience with you again in the next week. Until then, keep well.